Parliament is now in session. Your silence is commanded. Please be seated.
Morning. I'll call our first case, 06AP0405, Gregory Leibovich versus Minnesota Insurance Company. Michael, is it Mesereau?
Yes.
Representing the Minnesota Insurance Company. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Abramson, members of the court, counsel, and guests, thank you very much for agreeing to hear our case today. I think today the issues to be decided by this court are a number of them in terms of policy conclusions, policy terms, and a duty to defend. I think that first issue to be addressed by the court is to reaffirm what has been stated by this court and the other appellate courts in this state, that the duty to defend is determined solely by reviewing the allegations of the complaint and comparing that to the policy provisions to determine if there is a possibility of coverage. If there is no possibility of coverage under that scenario, there is no duty to defend. This court has restated that rule countless times.
Let me just interrupt for a moment. Is that true after a trial and after other facts are developed, or is this four corners just before trial, and that after trial you have different rules coming into play?
My experience is that when there is a trial, it's usually because there is the issue of whether or not there is coverage. For instance, a county.
Oh, no, that's if you have a decision pre-trial. But suppose insurance company says, no, we're not covering. The insured goes to trial using his or her own lawyer. And after the trial and the special verdicts, it's quite clear that there is coverage under the policy. What's the rule then?
I think if you have a factual determination at that point, it's actually preceded by the fact that there's a question of coverage. There's the question of the plausibility or possibility of coverage. At that point, you then have to have a factual determination. But if the allegations of the complaint compared to the policy don't raise the arguability, if you will, of coverage, then there simply is no duty to defend. And this court has continually upheld that proposition and has likewise held that if that is the case, that there is no possibility of coverage or coverage is not arguable, as the district court in Wisconsin in the Menasha case said, there is no penalty to the insurer. Another thing that the court needs to address in this case is the term of wrongful entry. Mr. Leibovich, in this case, has pursued that this is a covered claim because this is a wrongful injury. We've had a couple of issues that bear on that in terms of whether or not there's an offense, whether or not there's injury, but it boils down to a question of whether or not there has been a wrongful entry.
Is it merely limited to wrongful injury, or does it also involve invasion of privacy?
As I understand the briefing in this case, it's wrongful injury. Wrongful entry, excuse me.
I understand that that was your brief. I thought the point was made in the opposing counsel's brief that added the issue of invasion of privacy, and that's why I'm pressing you on it.
That is mentioned, but as I read their brief, I think they're addressing the question of wrongful entry. That was the issue decided by the Court of Appeals, that it was arguably a wrongful entry.
Counsel, does the wrongful entry in any way affect the view of the lake? In other words, is the wrongful entry strictly in terms of crossing a land barrier, or is it also in terms of air rights and view rights and that type of thing?
There is no crossing of the barrier. The question in the case is, was the violation of his own setback? Each of the properties have the 125-foot setback from the low-level water of the lake. So there hasn't been any physical entry or physical attachment or anything onto the other property, but there is a question of whether or not the view has been affected.
Right, and that's what I'm asking you. If that's indeed one of the questions, how does that affect the term wrongful entry? In other words, if the argument is that the wrongful entry here was an entry into our view of the lake. Is that a legitimate argument?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
I think we have to take a look at the term and its ordinary meaning. I mean, plaintiff in this case has tried to go at great lengths to go through dictionary definitions and has put term on term on term to try and create this question. But entry, I mean, if I look at this as a reasonable insured would look at this, entry means to enter. I haven't entered into the property.
Well, it depends on what you mean by property. Justice Crooks's question says, in effect, you've got an easement over this land. The neighbor has an easement over this land for purposes of viewing. It's the same issue or similar or analogous as you have an easement over land for ingress or egress or driving cars. If the landowner would put a structure on that easement, they are entering a property right of the neighbor, because the property right of the neighbor is the easement. And here, it's not an easement for ingress or egress, but it is an easement of view. That is, you have, I mean, the argument can be made that the neighbor has a right that the airspace from land up not be entered because they have an interest in that land. That interest is set forth in the restrictive deed. It could have been a deed, it could have been a shoreline, it could have been a shoreline ordinance. I mean, that's the question, I think.
It's a restrictive covenant. It's not.
Okay, but it doesn't matter. It gave the neighbor something on the land in issue. Well, maybe you disagree with that. That's the point.
I understand
the question.
Point. My point in response is that if we take the term entry in its ordinary common meaning, to go upon to take a look at the trespass definitions that we have.
Yeah, but it is a trespass. Wouldn't it be a trespass for me to build on Justice Bradley's easement on my land? That's a wrongful entry into Justice Bradley's ownership interest. It's not a full title ownership of the land, but it is an ownership of a property interest in my land.
You do have an ownership interest in the land.
Right.
But if we take the term in its everyday meaning, entry means to move into. Yeah.
And I moved into her easement, which is a property. Right. That's what I'm trying to tell you why that doesn't fit.
I think the closest thing that we can look at to analogize is the definition of trespass. Trespass
okay.
is a wrongful entry, and
right.
it's defined as occupying space mm-hmm. or property owned by another. Never in this case has there been an allegation that anything that Mr. Leibovich did encroached upon the property of the Halls and the Blazers.
Counselor, can't you have an injury to the property of someone else without entering on it? What if I open a meatpacking plant on my property and I'm rendering skins and stuff next door and it smells like heck and you live next to me? You know, aren't I interfering with the use of your property, but I'm not physically on your property?
But the odor is transferring to that property. So that's where the entry comes into play. If there hasn't been any physical passage from Leibovich's property onto the Hall or Blazer property, mm-hmm. I think a reasonable insured would have to conclude there hasn't been any wrongful entry.
What about if I, instead of building the house like it was built here, what about if I just build an 8-foot wall at the lake? I really can't stand the lake. It bothers me. So I don't like to see all that. So I build an 8-foot wall all across the front of my property, right at the lake, not my house, a little bit encroached in a setback. You don't think that has any effect on the neighbors' rights to use their property?
It may have an effect upon their rights, but we have to take into the context of what's provided in the insurance policy.
But isn't it an injury to their rights of their property? If they can't see the lake, I got this great big fence there.
I don't think it fits within the definition of injury contained within the policy. It has to be either property damage or personal injury. And the personal injury has to stem from the wrongful entry.
You're viewing the fee simple owner as owning all of that land, and therefore there was no entry into someone else's property. But the fee simple owner here does not have 100% rights in that land. The right is limited by someone else who has an interest in that land, namely the easement for view. Therefore, there's an entry on the easement for view owned by another. I mean, that's where you and I are not talking to each other and understanding. You're not willing to recognize that somebody else can have a property interest in the Leibovich land.
I think the purpose of the restrictive covenant is so that there isn't an an unobstructed view of the property. That I don't disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
What I disagree with is that this property interest that the trial court eventually found in this case doesn't fall within the terms of the policy.
Okay, that's fine. Why not?
First of all, it's not property damage. That issue hasn't been raised, although the Court of Appeals said it might have given an inference of property damage because the insured's property would have to be torn down. The policy doesn't cover damage to the owner. It's his own property under the liability coverages. So property damage is out. The only other possibility might be loss of use. Our court, most recently in the Everson case, has said loss of use means it's rendered totally unusable. That hasn't been alleged in the case. The question then becomes whether or not it's personal injury. Personal injury in the policy. Open the.
If you don't mind, when you refer to the policy, if you'd give us the page or the area that you're referencing.
It's in our appendix, page 133.
Thank you.
It talks about personal injury means injury, including bodily injury or mental harm arising from any of the following acts. And it enumerates A through H. The one we're dealing with here is wrongful entry or eviction. There has to be an entry to
and
cause.
And that's G.
Injury.
You're back to wrongful entry or eviction.
Right. That's 15G is the policy definition. So you can have an injury, but the question is whether or not there's an entry.
What about emotional distress?
It's not alleged.
Pardon me?
It's not alleged anywhere in the complaint.
Okay.
The complaint in the wherefore clause, I believe the second cause of action, says that, and to the extent not inconsistent with the relief requested, which relief specifically indicated that they are without an adequate remedy at law, that the court award damages. This court has stated that use of the term simply damages is not sufficient. I think the Smith versus Katz case talks about that. So the fact that there is some quote-unquote damage isn't sufficient for purposes of triggering the policy. If we take the position that the word damage means injury, it still has to arise from the wrongful entry.
Even if it's mental harm.
I'm not sure that we could presume or that it would be reasonable to presume that the allegations in this complaint arise.
I know, but even if it were, wouldn't your position be that you still need wrongful entry?
Absolutely.
So it doesn't matter if it's bodily injury or mental harm.
Right.
You still need wrongful entry as you interpret the policy.
Right.
Okay.
And wrongful entry, I'm sorry, is defined where in the policy?
It's not.
Okay. Why isn't this tantamount to a nuisance case for invasion of the, what's the phrase that you would use, the use and enjoyment, wrongful invasion of the use and enjoyment of your property? Why isn't that a...
I don't think that the underlying complaint in this case rises to the level of a nuisance claim. That's not alleged. They are seeking the injunctive relief. I suppose they could have alleged a nuisance claim, but they didn't. Under our notice pleading, while we're very liberal in what has to be pled, you have to at least give the insurer some kind of notice that there's something that arguably is covered under their policy. It's very clear in the complaint, second amended complaint actually in this case, they're alleging a violation of the restrictive covenant of the setback, that there was an intentional, willful disregard of the rights, that the actions of Mr. Leibovich were intentional, and that this resulted in, quote, damage. But in each of the causes of action, they're actually asking for injunctive relief in the form of having the house torn down or some other form of relief that really isn't covered under the policy.
If this were, and I don't know if it is or not, but if this were captioned as a nuisance case for the wrongful, invasion and the use and enjoyment of your property, can't see, you know, don't have a good view anymore, would it be covered?
Still gets down to the question of whether or not it's wrongful entry. And under the terms of this policy, as we read the policy, I don't think a nuisance constitutes an entry unless something has gone onto the property of another.
Mm-hmm. Invasion of privacy.
I don't think that falls within that classification. You're invading their space. Again, it involves some kind of action to physically invade their space.
I don't think in a wrongful, I don't know, because this hasn't been discussed, but it seems to me in a nuisance case, you don't need an invasion in terms of physically going on, if you define invasion as physically going on someone else's property. You have nuisance cases and all sorts of shapes and forms. I think there could be a nuisance case if I had a 2,000 pig operation next to my house that smelled. Of course, you say the odor would come on. Okay.
Right.
What about we have airport nuisance cases? How does that deal with it? Noise in the airport.
Well, again, we have another entry or invasion into the property. I mean, the airspace isn't confined to just over the airport. Obviously, the noise extends to wherever the jets are coming or going from.
Counselor, you said earlier on that property damage wasn't alleged, and of course, under the policy, property damage means physical injury to destruction of or loss of use of tangible property. Do you mean it wasn't alleged in the complaint? Because what they say in the section, in the second cause of action is interference with the interest of their neighbors. That's what was alleged against Leibovich. And do you mean it wasn't alleged, or do you mean it's just not been argued as being a basis for coverage?
Neither. It was not argued at the trial court or the appellate level that this was the basis for finding coverage. And it was not alleged. They alleged the amorphous term damages without any further description of it. I brought that up because the Court of Appeals said that it could have at least arguably raised the issue of property damage because the insured's building may have had to have been torn down. Mm-hmm. But there's a specific exclusion for that in the policy under the liability coverages. That exclusion is on page 142 of our appendix. There's exclusions 6 and 7. The first is property damage to property owned by or in the custody, care, and control of an insured person. Mr. Leibovich is obviously the insured person.
Yeah, but the interest that's claimed to be damaged in real property is the interest of their neighbor, not his interest. So I don't think that one fits. I mean, the interest that what's it says in the second claim for relief is that violation of the 125 building setback restriction has interfered with the interests of Hall and Blazer in and to their neighboring real property. So they didn't allege Leibovich had a damage to a property, so I don't see how that one fits.
I brought that up because that's what the Court of Appeals said in its decision.
Yeah. Well, no, but I'm looking at the exclusion because when I read it, property damage in your policy, which is a covered loss, says loss or use of tangible property. Okay, so the real estate is certainly tangible property, right? And it, and then you said, well, it doesn't apply because of item number 6 on page 142 in an exclusion, but that's Leibovitz's property, but what's alleged is not damage to Leibovitz's property, but damage to the neighbor's property.
They allege solely the term damage. The full definition on page 133 of property damage is property damage means physical injury to, destruction of, or loss of use of tangible property.
Right.
There's no allegation of physical injury to or destruction of property.
How about loss of use?
Under the Everson case decided by this court, I believe, 2 years ago, it means that the property has to be rendered useless.
I gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Get back a little bit to one of the first issues that the Court of Appeals addressed in its very first paragraph is the advertising. This has been continually brought up by Mr. Leibovitz during the trial court proceedings as well as the Court of Appeals proceedings. First of all, the advertising materials that are cited have nothing to do with the terms and conditions of the policy. I don't think that this court has ever, and I dare say will ever, say that we decide the terms of a policy based upon an advertisement for a sale of an insurance product. There are, if we look at the language in the endorsements, yes, there is broader coverage. First of all, the policy is a worldwide policy. Most homeowners' policies are confined to the United States and its territories. This is a worldwide policy.
Does the insurance, does the advertisement in any way inform the expectation of a reasonable insured?
No, it doesn't. It says that the coverages we're provided will be automobile, homeowners, excess liability, and then there's a number of other potential coverages.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me rephrase my question. Your argument is the four corners argument, and my question, perhaps more artfully stated, it is this. Can advertisements be taken into account when considering what the expectation of the reasonable insured would be? There are several canons of interpretation for insurance policies. One is what is the reasonable expectation of the insured? And my question then is, can an advertisement be part of that analysis when considering the reasonable expectation of the insured?
Under our case law, I don't think so. Very simply.
What case?
All of the cases that talk about if there's an ambiguity, we look at dictionary definitions, we look at the common ordinary term.
Is there any case that you know of that focuses on my question, that is whether or not an advertisement or some other information provided by the insurance company in any way affects the reasonable expectation of the insured?
I'm not aware of any specific case that says an advertisement is to be used. I believe that counsel has cited a case that talks about other factors, but it's very ambiguously worded in terms of what other factors. But we still get down to the basic premise that, first, the court has to find an ambiguity. If there is an ambiguity, then the court has to look at whether the interpretations that are offered are reasonable. And in terms of looking at whether or not it's reasonable, we look at dictionary definitions and other factors that would come into play. And I don't think, frankly, we have to go even to dictionary definitions.
But when a standard policy is ambiguous, the ultimate rule is you interpret it against the drafter, against the insurance company.
If there is a true ambiguity, yes.
Right. You don't think that this is ambiguous,
wrongful entry.
Okay.
I do not.
Go ahead.
Counsel, I was going to, because I know your time is getting short, ask you to address your argument in regard to the exclusion for intentional acts. I'd like you to at least touch on that and explain your position on that for us.
The exclusion in this case is found on page 143. The exclusion specifically says that it applies to personal injury or property damage arising from any criminal, willful, or malicious act or omission, also not cover claims or acts which any person, which are intended to result or would be expected to. It's not particularly different language than other language that's been handled by this court. In this case, each and every cause of action set forth in the second amended complaint says that the actions of Mr. Leibovich were intentional and in willful disregard of the rights of the plaintiffs.
Now, they're intentional because he did build the building. I mean, right. There's no question that it rose from other than his own doing. Okay.
Right. And the complaint further goes on to state that Mr. Leibovich was aware of this restriction and yet continued to build. I think my time's up, if I may still answer the question.
That, yes.
I think, Your Honor, what you're driving at is whether or not we might be able to infer the intent from the allegations in this case. And I think the answer is yes. The other cases that this court have addressed on inferring intent, such as the Raby case, Raby versus Moe, involved, for instance, in that case, participating in a robbery. And the court said that the actions of that individual are such that we can reasonably infer intent. I don't think we have to confine it to a personal injury case where a crime has been committed. This court has not set forth in the decisions that is the limited nature of when a court may infer intent. As been pointed out, Mr. Leibovich intentionally built this property. If there was no allegation that he was aware of the restriction and built it in defiance of that restriction, I think we'd have a different story here. There'd still be a question of whether there's an intentional act exclusion, but on the basis of the pleadings in this case, I don't think there's any other conclusion but to say that he knew or should have known that his actions were likely to result in injury, which is the exact injury that they point out has been claimed in this case.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
How do you then respond to the Court of Appeals, at least their ruling in paragraph 15, that talks in terms of this intent and how it's been interpreted, at least by the Court of Appeals in Ludwig versus Dullian. Under Wisconsin law, an intentional act restriction only excludes coverage when the insured acts intentionally and intends that some harm follow from his or her actions.
I think that's apparent from the second amended complaint. They allege throughout the complaint that the actions were intentional. It caused the injury or the harm. The harm being the violation of the setback, and the interest that they have in their property.
But as I understand the Court of Appeals' opinion, they're not saying that and it causes harm. The Court of Appeals is saying that they have to intend to cause the harm.
Correct. I understand that decision, but I think what our courts have said is that intent can be inferred as a result of the conduct that's been alleged.
Counselor, isn't this argument kind of at odds with your first argument that there isn't any harm? I mean, you're saying they intended to cause the harm, and that's what the complaint says, but then earlier on you say the complaint doesn't really allege a harm.
I won't say it's at odds, but when an insurance company is faced with an allegation, they first have to examine the allegations of the complaint to see if it falls within the coverage grant of the policy. If it falls within the coverage grant of the policy, then the company has to look at whether there are exclusions that would take it out. The intentional act exclusion is, I don't want to use the term last-ditch defense on this case. Our position is there hasn't been an occurrence because there's not a personal injury. It's not a personal injury. But if the court finds that there's a personal injury, it's excluded because of the intentional act exclusion.
Okay. I got you. Thank you. It's a step argument.
Correct.
Which provision of the complaint are you alleging makes this intentional? Because what the Court of Appeals said in 16, that the reasonable inference from the complaint was that they thought it was legal and illegal, that not that he knew he was building an illegal house and just did not care. So they look at the complaint much differently than you do. Paragraph 16. So I want you to pinpoint for me the complaint provisions that you are relying on.
In our appendix, page 167, paragraph 20.
167.
Appendix.
That's what I'm looking at. 167?
Right. Paragraph 26.
That's the red brief.
Correct.
Got it.
Paragraph 26.
Right.
Of the amended complaint. Leibovich's violation of the 125-foot building setback restriction was intentional in willful disregard of the rights of Hall and Blazer.
So the allegation here, and you're saying we just look at the complaint, is that this was an intentional act.
Absolutely.
And intending mean they intend the conduct and they intend the harm resulting therefrom.
Correct.
And the Court of Appeals said that the complaint accuses him of willful disregard of their rights, that he refused to call what they thought was illegal. But you're saying that says what he did that in willful disregard. That's the complaint, as you interpret it.
I have to profess, I'm not sure how the Court of Appeals came up with that analysis, because the complaint is very clear in its allegations.
Well, I'll tell you how. This is a it's a fact, but not one that's readily – it's an allegation of fact, but not readily provable, because intent, although is a fact, you can't find it. You can't look at it. It has to be inferred.
Right.
And that they're inferring from this that that it was intent, it was in willful disregard. I mean, obviously it was intentional. That is, where he put the building was intentional.
Right.
So, and that's very interesting. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes in
yes.
rebuttal. Wait a minute, one other question which you can look at while you're sitting down. In your reply brief, you ask us to strike the fact section of the respondent's brief because it violates 809.19.1d. I would like you to address that.
Yes.
Because I want to know if that's a serious motion you're making or whether it's fluff in the reply brief. So you can do that when you come back.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Axelrod, Attorney John P. Axelrod, representing Gregory Leibovich. You should also respond to that, Mr. Axelrod, because you will only get one shot.
I will, Your Honor. Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, fellow counsel, my name is John Axelrod, and I have the privilege today of representing Mr. Leibovich. The fundamental problem with the argument that you just heard from AIG is that it still, after 2 years of briefing, refuses to acknowledge, let alone honor, the fact that this is a special policy. It's a very, very different policy than any other homeowner's policy in the state. And my opponent indicates that that in interpreting that very special policy that the advertisements should not be looked at, but what he's ignoring is that in the policy itself, and I invite the Court's attention to our appendix, it's Mr. Leibovich's appendix LA-72, page LA-72, that the policy says to better serve you, our websites provide information about our products. So the website information that we have cited in our brief is fair game because it's incorporated in the policy. And I also invite the Court's attention to the case of Swart versus Rural Mutual, where our Court of Appeals said that where an insurance contract is uncertain and the intention of the parties is not clearly ascertainable from the policy itself, the courts will take into consideration the apparent object or purpose of the insurance and the context of the policy and so forth. So I think that it was not only appropriate, but I think that it was necessary to, with this very broad and in some senses ambiguous policy, it was necessary to determine what exactly did AIG say in order to get the premium. And then once it got the premium, is AIG walking away from its responsibilities, or must they honor both what they say in the policy and what they say on the website.
Now, okay, but are you interpreting the website to say, in effect, we're covering everything?
No, I'm on the website, Your Honor, it says, for example, that this policy is not an off-the-shelf policy, and that it's designed to provide much broader coverage than an off-the-shelf policy. And I quote, it's designed specifically to enhance protection and minimize threats to the personal wealth and safety of our clients. And I think the most incredible thing about this policy is that unlike the ordinary homeowner's policy, this policy protects the insured against defenses. It's as incredible as it may seem. One of the things that AIG induces its insureds to pay a premium for is that they will be protected against not only accidents, but they will be protected against defenses. And then if you look at other aspects of the policy, they're simply amazing in the breadth. For example, in the ordinary homeowner's policy, personal injury is limited to a series of enumerated acts, and we've cited Miller's. The Miller's compendium gives you the language of the standard insurance policy, and yet in this particular policy, the term personal injury is not limited to a list of enumerated acts. It says personal injury means injury, and the policy writers didn't even take the time to define what they mean by injury, which allows this court to go to the dictionary and determine what the meaning of injury is in the dictionary. And a few other examples that are just quite amazing.
Counselor, can I stop you for just a minute on that?
Sure.
Personal injury? I'm looking at 133 of the appendix, and I tear my stuff out of your books, but I think it is the insurance company's appendix. And it's paragraph 15, which talks about personal injury. And it says personal injury means injury, which is what you're talking about, including bodily or mental harm arising out of any of the following acts. And then it lists the acts. And I guess my question to you is this. Is that statement ambiguous, or is it clear? And I want you to tell me why you think it's one or the other.
The grammar is very interesting, and I think that if you compare that language, for example, to the language in Miller's, you will see readily that under this language, personal injury means injury, which can mean anything, including bodily injury or mental harm arising out of.
But if it includes it, does it exclude anything that's not on the list?
No, Your Honor. That's my concern. No, Your Honor. It could have said, arising out of the following acts. Instead, it says including arising out of any of the following acts. So what that indicates to me as somebody trying to stand in the shoes of the reasonable insured is that the injury can include what's set forth here, but it also can include other types of injuries as well. But even if we were to limit ourselves to what the examples are, the breadth of those examples is just astounding. For example, invasion of privacy is covered without any limitation whatsoever, whereas in the Miller's annotation, which is cited in our brief, invasion of privacy is limited to oral or written publications of materials.
Your argument, Mr. Axelrod, undercuts your basic premise to me. Basic premise is this is a very broad form policy, broader than the usual that's in Miller's. I'm familiar with that series of books. Now, and that's what they say in their advertisements. We're giving you more than everybody else does. So now you're only telling me they're living up to their advertisements. But the fact that they are giving you more than anybody else and are giving you a broad policy does not mean that you're saying we're going to pay you for anything at all that happens in this year. This is a long policy, right? How many pages? Small print pages. And it clearly states that personal injury, broadly defined as bodily injury with no limits, mental harm, no limits, broader than most policies. But it limits it to wrongful entry or eviction. So you can't just say, just because it's broader, they got to cover your client. They gave him a policy.
Let me address wrongful injury.
Wrongful entry, because...
Let me address that.
You have to come on to A through H?
I don't think you do, but let's assume for the sake...
That was my question, whether or not that was an exclusive list.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that the court was to disagree with me and determine that you have to come under A through H. I think that we come under it under invasion of privacy, because that was one of the torts, if you will, that was found by Judge Carlson, emotional injury, which was found by Judge Carlson, and wrongful entry.
Just a minute. Found by Judge Carlson on what basis?
After hearing the evidence, Judge Carlson awarded $10,000 in damages. Certainly,
after a trial?
After a trial.
I thought we look at this. That's the question I asked your opposing counsel. Do we look at this only on the complaint, or do we look at this after trial? So, first of all, tell me what before trial. Let's look at it at the complaint, because that's what he emphasized.
Okay. The question under this court's decision in Elliott and Newhouse is whether there is the potential for coverage. And this court has said that if there is any doubt that the insurance company needs to defend, not forever, but just for that very short period of time until a motion for stay, a motion for bifurcation, and coverage can be determined by Judge Carlson. And what we really fault AIG for in this case is that it failed to follow the very reasonable procedure set down by this court in Elliott and Newhouse. This all could have been resolved in a coverage trial. The fact that three Court of Appeals judges said that there was the potential for coverage here, I think, means that the question of coverage was not free from doubt, even if this court should ultimately disagree.
Wouldn't you have brought a motion or a suit saying you have a duty to defend us?
That was one of the basis for the trial court's decision. But in this policy, Your Honor, there is a provision that Mr. Leibovich could not bring an action against the insurance company until there was a judgment against him. But I want to answer your question on the Four Corners rule. Why are Judge Carlson's findings admissible under the Four Corners rule? Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, we are suing, Your Honor, not only for breach of the duty to defend, but we're suing for breach of the duty to indemnify. So certainly on that basis, Judge Carlson's findings of invasion of privacy, wrongful entry, and mental distress.
That's under indemnification.
Are extremely important. And once, Your Honor, there is a duty to indemnify, there, of course, is a duty to defend, because the duty to defend is much broader than the duty to indemnify. But I'm not answering your question. Your question is post Judge Carlson. So why are Judge Carlson's findings important if you look at this thing in terms of post? Since the test is whether the complaint alleged a potential for coverage, what better evidence is there than how a trial judge in this state ultimately determined that complaint? Because under a notice pleading rule, the standard for the evidence and for the types of acts and torts that Judge Carlson could consider at trial is, of course, determined by the four corners of that complaint as well. So since Judge Carlson found that the complaint under notice pleading rules was broad enough to allow him to make findings as to wrongful entry, invasion of privacy, and mental distress, isn't this an example? Doesn't this prove the point? In fact,
no,
better
because
evidence
you can bring in evidence that's different than the complaint, and if no one objects, the rule is the complaint is amended. Isn't that the rule?
There was no, in the underlying case, Your Honor, there was never.
Let me just ask, why aren't you suing for indemnification? Why aren't you suing for indemnification?
We are.
All
and,
right.
And we did.
So why are we fussing with the complaint?
There is, the Court of Appeals, in its analysis, said there was a breach of the duty to defend. Therefore, the insurer AIG was stopped from denying coverage. A separate and independent basis for this court to find coverage and to allow Mr. Leibovich's defense costs are that at trial it was ultimately found that there was a covered loss. And my good friend Mr. Mesereau doesn't, in his brief, ever once state that Judge Carlson's findings do not trigger the indemnity clause. Rather, he takes the position that if there's no duty to defend, there's no duty to indemnify. But, of course, that would completely nullify the promise that's made, the separate promise that's made, that we will cover you from any act that's within the four squares of the policy. So I do agree with you, Chief Justice Abrahamson, that I think an alternative basis for this court to affirm the Court of Appeals would be to determine that there is a duty to indemnify, and since there's a duty to indemnify, it's only fair that Mr. Leibovich get his defense costs as well.
Well, that's a second step, though. I mean, don't you have to show there's a duty to defend before you can get the defense costs? Isn't that why you're arguing?
And I'm not shying away from that, Justice Robinsack. I do believe that there was that there was a duty to defend, and if you analyze this complaint in the broadest possible terms, and I do disagree with some of the statements that were made by my opponent, let's look for example at paragraph 27 of the complaint. That's at page LA-91 of our appendix. Hall and Blazer are aggrieved by Leibovich's violation of the building setback restriction. Aggrieved under the dictionary means injury. And then if you turn to the page LA-93, the second cause of action, right at the top of the page, that paragraphs 1 through 28 are realleged, and then paragraph 29 has a wherefore clause. And in the wherefore clause, it requests, it states that Leibovich's encroachment, in other words, encroaches an allegation of wrongful entry. And then it goes on and it says that to the extent not inconsistent with plaintiff's request for injunctive relief, plaintiffs seek damages in an amount to be determined by the court or jury. So, it seems to me, looking at this complaint, we have an allegation of injury, we have an allegation of wrongful entry, and we have an allegation of invasion of privacy or mental distress or something from the very broad allegation that there was an injury. Now, with respect, Justice Rogensack, to one of your questions, to my opponent, with respect to can you have an interest in land off the property of Hull and Blazer themselves? And I think the answer to that question is Section 844.01 sub 2 of the statutes, which says that physical injury includes unprivileged intrusions and encroachments. And then there's a semicolon, and it says the injury may be surface, subsurface, or supersurface, and then another semicolon, the injury may arise from activities on the plaintiff's property or from activities outside the plaintiff's property, which affects the plaintiff's property. And I think that Chief Justice Abrahamson, your example of an easement is certainly consistent with that statute. Riparian rights are certainly consistent with that statute. But if you go back to the policy itself, what we find extremely remarkable is that the term wrongful entry is totally undefined. If you look at page 28 of our brief, we created a chart, and we reproduced the language from the Scottish Guarantee case before Judge Crabb in the Seventh Circuit. We reproduced the language from the City of Edgerton versus General Casualty. And in all of in those two other cases, the definition of wrongful entry required some sort of invasion of a room or an activity on somebody else's land. But if
Mr. Axelrod, let me interrupt for a moment.
Certainly.
Let's assume that you're right on down the line. Then you run into the intentional act exclusion. And I want to know how you get around that intentional act exclusion.
Very easily, Your Honor. And that question was asked of Mr. Mesereau. And specifically, if you look at our appendix, page LA-63 and LA-64, it starts on LA-63, intentional acts. We do not cover any laws caused by any act whose consequences could have been foreseen by a reasonable person committed, A, by or at the direction of you, your spouse, or a family member, and, B, with the intent to cause loss or damage. And there's absolutely no allegation in the complaint that Mr. Leibovich intended to cause loss or damage. In fact, at trial, Judge Carlson found that he had made an honest mistake. And in the pleading itself, the plaintiff hedges its bets. The plaintiff state that the acts were either with actual notice or they were with constructive notice. Well, certainly the allegation of constructive notice could not allege an intentional act, because constructive notice is simply that the easements were recorded or the restrictive covenants were recorded at the Walworth County Register of Deeds. So I think the intentional acts is a red herring under their policy. And also there's an ambiguity in the policy, because if you look at the occurrence section, an offense is defined as an intentional act. So in the occurrence section, they seem to provide coverage for intentional acts, and then you have this inconsistency in the exclusion section.
But you do have an allegation in the complaint in paragraph 26, if I remember correctly, specifically talking about this being intentional. And how do we ignore that?
There's a difference, Your Honor, between somebody intending to build a house, in this case Mr. Leibovich, and Mr. Leibovich intending to build the house, to use the language of the exclusion, with the intent to cause loss or damage. Now certainly, I think it's reasonable to assume that any person that builds a house intends the consequences of his acts. That's to build a house. But I think it's totally unreasonable to assume that Mr. Leibovich built his house with the intent to cause loss or damage to his neighbors. I mean, I think that's an absurd construction, because obviously, he was building his house for shelter. He was building his house. He retained an architect, according to the record, and he was building his house for enjoyment. There's not a single allegation, and there was no evidence at trial that he was building the house to intend to cause loss or damage.
How many feet did he infringe?
I think it was 106 versus 125, Your Honor.
So he 19 or so.
19. And you'll recall from the Court of Appeals decision in the underlying case that the issue was where the 125 feet started. Did it start at the high water mark? Did it start at a rock? And that resulted in Judge Carlson finding as a fact, and that's before you, that Mr. Leibovich acted reasonably and had made an honest mistake. And that was one of...
So why did he give $10,000 damages?
For invasion of privacy and mental distress. Obviously, somebody can act negligently and cause damage as well.
Mr. Axelrod, the petition for review in this case, which was filed, of course, by the insurance company, only talked about the complaint. Your response also talked about the complaint, and your brief talks about only the duty to defend and the complaint, except for pages 36, 37, 36 and half of 36 and 37. So most of this brief deals with complaint, not the trial, not the duty to indemnify.
And that's because
in the response brief, the insurance company spends a half a page saying there's no duty to indemnify, because once you find there's no duty to defend, the duty to indemnify is dead. I mean, that's there, and they cite two cases. So my real question to you is that both in the trial court, in the Court of Appeals, and in this court, almost entirely the issue is duty to defend on the basis of the four corners of the complaint and how you interpret and apply that rule. And very little is spent on indemnification. And I don't know how this court can then move into indemnification on the basis of the very scanty discussions by both you and the insurance company.
Well, two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, it's never been disputed to this date that there was the duty to indemnify.
A dispute to this day. The insurance company is disputing it.
Certainly,
your argument is counter to the well-established principle that duty to defend is broader than duty to indemnify. And once it's determined that the insurance had no duty to defend, it has no duty to indemnify.
Well, I think the starting point, Your Honor, is that Judge Carlson found wrongful entry. He found invasion of privacy. He found mental distress.
The trial.
Those are covered at the trial. We're not shying away from the duty to defend, and we think we can win this case and should win this case on the duty to defend as well, because when that complaint was served on Mr. Leibovich, the question was, did it raise the possibility of coverage? Was the matter free from doubt? And I think that that as I said before, even if this court came to a different conclusion than the Court of Appeals, that the one thing I think we can all agree upon, and I think that's evidence in the court's questions and the presentation here today, is that these are complex issues. This matter was not free from doubt. And if there ever was a case where the procedures that this court set down in Newhouse and Elliott was important, it was this case. And I think it's worthwhile contrasting this case with this court's decision in 2005 in Everson versus Lorenz. That was a very difficult and complex case as well. But Pekin Insurance Company in that case acted very differently than Mr. Misero's client, AIG. What Pekin Insurance Company did is they defended, they moved to stay, they moved to intervene, they had their coverage trial, and at the coverage trial it was decided that there was no coverage, that decision was affirmed by this court. And this is exactly what AIG should have done in this case. AIG had no right under this court's decision, under these facts, to take the law into its own hands. If ever there was a case which required a neutral and detached decision maker, i.e. a circuit judge, to determine these complex issues, that was this case. And what would it have cost AIG? AIG could have spent a half hour in defense costs to prepare an answer. Once they filed their motion to stay, their motion to intervene, Judge Carlson would have been duty-bound under the Newhouse and Elliott case to stay the liability provisions or the liability part of the trial, and he would have been required to immediately proceed to coverage to determine, not in terms of what's alleged, but in terms of what the actual facts were, whether this was a covered loss. How hard would that have been for AIG? What defense costs would they have incurred by proceeding that way besides the half hour to prepare an answer? None, Your Honors, because...
Please finish.
None, Your Honors, because the underlying case would have been stayed. And there would have been no need to defend while these coverage issues were taken up. So it seems to me that I think that this policy is, because it's such a broad policy, and because the issues of policy construction are really not likely to recur, given that this is not your typical homeowner's policy, I think that the part of this case that that guidance and a published decision from this court cries out for is a reiteration of the rule that the insurance system in Wisconsin works much better.
Counsel, I'm going to ask a question, and that is, what do we do when there's a tension between the four corners of the complaint and then the coverage case that has been tried? For instance, where in the complaint do you allege invasion of privacy? And yet we have a trial court finding of invasion of privacy. How are we to resolve what in my mind is a tension? If I look at the four corners of this complaint, I say you do not allege, at least hypothetically, unless you show me someplace else, you do not allege a cause of action for invasion of privacy. And yet then you have a court, so you're out on the four corners rule with regard to that. And yet you have a court trial where the court finds, oh, there's an invasion of privacy here, and of course that is one of the things that's covered under the policy. What do we do when you have that tension?
The tension is that you move to stay, you move to bifurcate, and you have a coverage trial. Because the first thing that would have happened at that coverage trial, Your Honor, it may have been done on summary judgment, is any competent defense counsel would have sent interrogatories to the plaintiffs, and they would have said in paragraph 28, where you allege, without specifics, that Hall and Blazer were aggrieved, i.e. injured. What did you mean?
Okay, is there any place in the complaint that you can point to that would show where you have pled invasion of privacy?
The answer is that when the Hall and Blazer plaintiffs simply pleaded that they were injured, that raised the potential for coverage because it did not rule out invasion of privacy. It did not rule out mental distress. And that's why this court in Elliott and Newhouse has the potential for coverage rules, because in a notice pleading, they're often incomplete. That's the teaching of the Allison versus Tycor case in the Seventh Circuit, which we cite in our brief. So we believe that and I see that I'm out of time, Justice Bradley.
You may answer the question.
We believe that given the fact that this allegation of wrongful entry was clearly made, but given the fact that this other allegation of injury was broadly made, that invasion of privacy could not be ruled out. And since it could not be ruled out, it should have gone to the coverage trial before Judge Carlson. There would have been interrogatories, would have asked the plaintiff, what kind of injury are you alleging? The plaintiff would have answered by saying invasion of privacy and mental distress, because that was the theory of their case in court. And Judge Carlson would have decided based upon that evidence whether there was coverage or not coverage. And the reason that we're here today, it seems to me, is not because this complaint rule something in or this complaint rules something out, but because AIG took the law into its own hands, and it should have had a neutral and detached person, such as a circuit court judge, make that determination where everybody could be heard. Instead, AIG simply walked away. They abandoned their insured, and we don't believe that was appropriate under this court's precedence.
Axelrod, thank you, but Justice Crooks has a question.
I'm sorry. I know you're not going to get to a chance otherwise to respond to this, but in the reply brief of your opponent, there is a request that this court should disregard and or strike Leibovitz's statement of facts. Do you have any response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that it's objective. We think that it falls within the bounds of fair advocacy. He faults us, for example, because we said the advertisement touts. Perhaps instead of saying touts, we could have said the word states, but I think that's a distinction without a difference. This court sees many briefs. I think it's fair comment. There was a lot of material to cover within the page limits set by this court, and we tried to do it in the most efficient and effective manner, and we certainly acted in good faith and would like the court to give us the benefit of the doubt in that regard.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Axelrod. Mr. Mesereau.
Begin by addressing the first question, or the last question actually asked by the court regarding the perceived allegations, or the allegations that the statement of facts is not objective. We refer to page 7, about the middle of the page of the...
What brief, Mr.?
Mr. Axelrod's brief,
okay,
plaintiff's brief.
That's the blue brief.
The policy covers, quote, personal injury, close quote, which the policy defines merely as, quote, injury, close quote. I'm okay with that. But then it says, and then provides a non-exhaustive list of examples. I don't think that the term non-exhaustive is objective.
Counselor, I'm going to bring you to a halt and let you finish in just a minute. But that was really my question. And I was going to ask you as soon as you got done with this, but since you poke holes at that, I want to tell you what I'm troubled with. If we were to conclude that paragraph 15 on page 133 of the appendix, which is personal injury means injury, including, and that including is not an exhaustive list, that would make that paragraph ambiguous, correct?
No. I think under the term...
Okay, go ahead. You can answer.
Under the term of, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher the Latin pronunciation, the justum generis, when there is a specific and a general term, they have to be used in conjunction in terms of what is followed in terms of language. Essentially, what Leibovich is asking, that because of the lack of a comma after the word including bodily injury or mental harm, comma, that you disregard all of that language as soon as the term injury is alleged. It doesn't make sense when you look at that particular paragraph. It has to be injury, which includes bodily injury or harm, which arise from the actions that are enumerated there.
But when you say including, you could have said limited to bodily injury or harm, and then the guy on the street that buys the policy, I think, would have a better understanding. When you say including, that doesn't mean it doesn't include something else.
No, but it still has to... And the term injury really isn't the crux of this case. The crux of this case is whether or not the allegations of the complaint constitute an occurrence, and the occurrence has to result from a personal injury being from wrongful entry.
But the crux of the complaint for me, frankly, is whether the policy is ambiguous or straightforward. Because if it's ambiguous, and it's ambiguous enough that it could be interpreted to include interference with real property, which is what is alleged in the complaint under Chapter 844, the second claim for relief, if the policy is ambiguous enough to include something other than those lists here, then I think under our case law, the insurance company's on the hook.
The second amended complaint, if I may, never alleged an action under 844.01. That's an argument that Mr. Axelrod has raised.
I've got the complaint in front of me, and let me just get you and read to you what I'm relying on. So if I'm wrong, you can straighten me out here. Okay. I refer you to, it's 169. It may be in your brief. It may be in somebody else's brief. It's paragraph 29, second cause of action. And then it's alleged, enter judgment pursuant to WSSTAT 844.20. 844.20 is the damages and equitable relief section out of Chapter 844. 844 is intentional interference with real property. So, I mean, it seems to me they pointed out the statute specifically, 844.20, and they wouldn't have had to say that, but... I read that.
That's
broad
a
enough
prayer
to
for
be,
relief. That's the prayer for
it may
relief.
Be, it may, it is not, it's not at the very end of the complaint. It's listed underneath the claim for relief. The bottom prayer for relief, okay. I think under notice pleading it's enough that it should draw your attention when they say they violated the setback restriction has interfered with the interests of Hall and Blazer. Now, perhaps 844 is in the prayer for relief, but that section of the statute is the same as what's alleged in terms interfered with the interests. And my concern as I read the policy, that particular paragraph, is whether that's ambiguous enough under injury to include something other than is in the particular list. And that's why I stopped you when you said you thought that the list was non-exclusive, that that was not a fair use of what's in the policy. And I guess I am concerned about the very same thing.
The term injury is modified or has to be from, whether we consider it's 844.20, Mr. Axelrod and Mr. Leibovich in their brief refer to 844.01, but we have to determine whether or not the injury is from a wrongful entry. That's where the analysis comes in.
If you do, if the list is exclusive, I agree with you. If the list is not exclusive, you don't.
My question is the same as Justice Rogan's. The language of the policy says personal injury means injury, including the following list. Mr. Axelrod has argued that that is not limiting. You appear to be arguing that this is limiting.
Right.
And that's the problem. I'm having the same problem that Justice Rogan is having, that means and includes are two different modifiers there. And meaning injury. Injury is not defined. And you have the allegation in paragraph 29, and I'm not going to go to the wherefore clause, but in paragraph 29, has interfered with the interests of Hall and Blazer in and to their neighboring real property. Why doesn't that constitute an injury under the policy?
Because it's not an injury that arises from a wrongful entry. That's where we have to. It doesn't say we cover every injury. It has to arise from one of the enumerated acts.
But the policy does say it covers every injury. And it says that it includes the following. It doesn't limit it to the following.
I respectfully disagree. I think the policy has to be read in light of common sense. I mean, if I take a look at the language injury, the personal injury means injury, then the rest of that language of that clause is rendered surplusage. And that's not an appropriate rule that this court follows.
Let's see if I can clarify it, if I understand your argument. Your argument is personal injury means injury, and you use the word means injury, but then you're going to define injury to include not only bodily injury, because after you're talking about personal injury, but also mental harm, because many times personal injury does not include mental harm. Okay. And therefore, you have a very broad definition of injury. You would put a comma after harm. And you're saying the word including defines injury. And that the phrase arising out of any of the following acts means all of the following acts. So it really reads personal injury means injury arising out of any of the following acts.
Correct.
That's the way you read it.
I think that's the way it has to be read.
And both Justice Rogensack and Justice Butler are saying to you they read the words, or they think they can read the words, including to mean including those acts, including the following acts, but not limited to the following acts. That's what they're saying. And that's what Mr. Axelrod's position is.
Right. And our position is the injury has to arise from the wrongful
injury. Right. Let's go back to my question about the facts.
Yeah, I'm sorry, because I interrupted you. Please continue.
Okay.
Another citation that we have is on page 9 of the plaintiff's brief. With the use of the terms extremely broad and unusual AIG private client group policy. Again, we don't feel that the term broad and unusual is an objective term. Also on page 11, there is another entry. Right in the middle of the page under the highlighting that says the underlying case before Judge Carlson, the end of the sentence, and to this day ignores its own policy language. That's the whole case here right now, whether or not there has been a complaint that falls within the policy language. It's our position. We have not ignored the policy language. And regardless, using the term ignore is not an objective term appropriate for a statement of facts in this court. I know my time is out, but I'd like to at least make one comment because there's been references to the trial court, Judge Carlson's findings in this case, finding an invasion of property and emotional injury. That is not what Judge Carlson found. Judge Carlson, in his findings of fact,
they appear in, I think, the appendix of DeWitt Ross. Isn't that right? Is that what we're going to look at? Okay, just give me the page number, please.
You have to stand by the microphone, too, Counselor. Thank you.
L.A. What?
On Leibovich's appendix, page 136, paragraph 112 is the only paragraph that talks about this. And it says, has been injured by Leibovich's violation of the deed restrictions. They have lost a real interest in property. They are entitled to an award of damages to compensate them for Leibovich's blocking of their view. There is no mention, and there is no mention elsewhere in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, that there has been an invasion of privacy or that there has been an emotional injury. That's simply a misstatement. Aside from the fact that the findings of fact by the trial court in the underlying case are still irrelevant for purposes of this court determining a duty to defend. That's plain and simple from the allegations of the complaint. The allegations of this complaint don't pass muster. Take a look at the Everson case. I asked the court to revisit the Everson case and take a look at that. Paragraph 27. After discussing the Smith case, where the court found that there wasn't a sufficient statement to invoke the coverage there, they said, the court stated as follows. The complaint simply alleges that the property was, quote, unbuildable, close quote, for the plaintiffs, and that they were forced to incur, quote, damages as a result. Damages, close quote, as a result. Continuing a couple sentences later. We give this language its plain meaning and conclude that Everson's complaint did not trigger insurance coverage for Lorenz and thus a duty for Pekin to defend Lorenz. That's the same thing we have here. All we have here is an allegation of damage in that part of the wherefore clause of the second cause of action. Nowhere in the complaint does the allegation appear, and the reference simply to a term of damage isn't sufficient under the policy. Reference to a term aggrieved, I really enjoyed Judge Gibbs's description, say, you know, if the call goes against the Packers, I'm aggrieved of that, but that doesn't come under my policy that a reasonable insured would expect to be covered. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. I'm sorry. Justice Prosser would like to ask you a question.
Can personal injury include monetary damages, monetary loss?
Personal injury would be a compensation for a physical injury. So the awarding of $5,000, I don't think, is tied in for anything that's covered under the policy.
What I'm trying to get at is it really goes to how broad personal injury is. I see down here wrongful entry or eviction. Let's suppose a person was wrongly evicted. Well, they might suffer some mental harm. They're not likely to suffer any physical injury. They might suffer some mental harm. But they could obviously suffer some monetary loss. Is that not covered?
If a person is wrongfully evicted and they suffer monetary damages, yes, that would be covered.
Okay.
Where do you find that in your policy?
I think the reference to the term injury would encompass that, but it's from a wrongful eviction.
Okay.
So, for instance, if property is, let's say the landlord wrongfully sells the property that the insured or the tenant had there.
So your answer to Justice Prosser is that injury is broad enough to cover cover monetary damages, and the words including bodily or mental harm are just illustrative of an injury.
I think it would probably fall more appropriately under the property damage coverage because...
Okay, wait, that's why I'm...
If the property is sold, that's really where the damages come in.
Is that 16?
Yes.
Property damage means physical injury to destruction of or loss of use of tangible property. So if you're evicted, you think that's loss or use of tangible property?
I believe so.
And therefore, it doesn't come under 15. So what would wrongful entry cover or eviction? That might be mental harm.
Right.
Okay. So your answer, Justice Brasser, is it comes under 16, not 15, on page 133.
I think the question...
Are there any other questions? Go ahead, Justice Brasser.
The argument was made, and it was discussed repeatedly. Personal injury means injury, and that it isn't an exhaustive list here. Is it just irrational? Is that an irrational argument that was made or considered here? I mean, could nobody could take that into account?
I'm not sure irrational is the right or the wrong term to use for the argument. I think the argument doesn't make sense when you look at the clause, paragraph 15, at its whole. There has to be some injury from one of the enumerated facts. That's where the limitation comes in the policy. It's not so much the question of injury as opposed to whether it arises from one of the enumerated acts.
You're saying to read it the way Axelrod does is personal injury means injury, including bodily or mentally harm. I'm sorry, to read it the way you want, arising out of, but not limited to, any of the following acts.
I think Mr. Axelrod is reading it differently. I think he's just saying it's essentially personal injury means injury, period, effectively. And then, in addition to that, including bodily injury or mental harm that arises from the acts. And I don't think that's an appropriate reading of the term. It has to be injury, including bodily injury or mental harm, which arise from the acts. So injury has to arise.
The word includes doesn't cover any of the following acts. That's your position. The word includes means bodily or mentally harm.
Yes.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Hearing none, I will thank counsel, both Mr. Mesereau and Mr. Axelrod, for their arguments today on an insurance case that involves issues we've had before, namely for the four-corner interpretation, but in a very different kind of a fact situation. Just a minute, please. Hold on. Because they came in late, I was not able to welcome CYD School of Excellence. We've got students from that school. Would they stand? Now you can stand. And other students from that school, we want to thank you for coming today and participating in our Court with Class program. That's sponsored by this court and the State Bar, and it is a national award-winning program that brings students to hear oral argument. And would you be able to participate afternoon today? Okay. Well, if you are, you're welcome back to a presentation by one of the justices relating to the procedures the court uses, not the substantive issues that are involved in this case, and everyone is invited. It is not limited to the students. Thank you for coming. We'll take a few moments of recess so that other students may